Familiar and Beloved is a whole new collection of stories set in the same world as Old Gods of Appalachia. And while we will honor our promise not to harm or kill our furry friends, listener discretion is still advised. Also, this story takes place in the years following the events of Black Mouth Dog. So if you haven't finished that tale yet, we recommend you do that before coming on this journey with us. Go on if you need to. We'll wait right here for you, family. Waylon Boggs sat on the porch with his mama and her younger brother, Digger. It was a calm, peaceful sort of evening. The sky above clear and full of stars. Crickets chirped in the darkness, frogs sang on the banks of a creek that ran along the back edge of the property. Somewhere in the trees, a lonesome hoot owl called into the night, looking for a mate to help feather his nest. Digger McCoy, however, had fallen silent. In the glow of the lamplight through the window behind him, he looked pale and haunted. A holler-eyed ghost of the affable storyteller who had held forth when they first brought their dessert out onto the porch. Waylon glanced nervously over at his mama as the lull in their conversation began to grow awkward. Onetta tipped him a reassuring nod and gently cleared her throat.
Well, I think I'm about ready for another cup of coffee. What about you boys? Another slice of pie?
As Onetta gave a long stretch and pushed herself up out of her chair, Waylon picked up her cue, answering as if he hadn't even noticed the shift in his uncle's mood.
I'll take some, Mama. Coffee, anyway. Maybe not pie.
Digger chuckled darkly, not looking at his sister, his eyes fixed on the dark woods beyond the yard.
Maybe something a little stronger for me, Netta.
Onetta nodded and squeezed her brother's shoulder gently before she gathered up their plates and cups and retreated into the kitchen. The two men fell quiet again at her departure, though the air between them had grown lighter, no longer straining under the weight of past horrors and years of hurt left unspoken. Digger busied himself with packing his pipe with fresh tobacco. The familiar motions of a routine he could have carried out blindfolded, soothing his troubled heart. When he began to hum absentmindedly, Waylon finally found the nerve to give voice to one of the multitude of questions tumbling through his head.
The water source he found, was it infected somehow with the dark?
No, boy. What you don't understand, what a lot of people don't understand and damn well should, is not everything of the green has mankind's best interest at heart. Human beings are the smartest and most capable creatures this old world has ever produced. We were meant to be her stewards, her protectors. At least, that's the feeling I get. But what have we done with all her gifts? Plundered and ravaged them, poisoned the soil? There's some that do their duty by her, tend their patch with care and respect. But most folks are oblivious at best. At worst, we've become the worst kind of infestation, and there are parts of the green that seem to feel it would be best to pull us out by the roots.
Walk with me, my little friend. Through these hills until we reach the end. The magic of fire, the whisper of wind, the depths of the earth reaches in. Soft little balls, step lively now. A howl in the night, forest comes alive. Ooh, the moon starts to rise. Cats on a prowl, dogs on a trail, a lonesome call, familiar song, oh, bring us home, bring us home.
Waylon and Digger sat in silence for a time after his uncle's grim pronouncement. Although Digger's tone had darkened, he didn't go still as he had before. He finished readying his pipe and lit up a smoke, leaning back comfortably into the old rocking chair where he sat. He gave the porch a gentle nudge with his foot and began to rock, gazing out into the night again, but not as before. No, he felt more present now. And so Waylon ventured another question.
So how did you get away from the water, I mean?
I didn't. I laid in that clearing for something like 30 hours before Daddy and the other boys' fathers found us. Jeremiah, Hank, Ansel, all dead. Drowned on dry land. No survivors, only me.
And thank the stars for that. Who knows what could have happened to you out there if it had taken Daddy much longer to find you.
Onetta Boggs exclaimed as the door swung open behind them, interrupting her brother's increasingly agitated rambling with the no-nonsense cheer that Waylon found both endearing and exasperating. In this instance, he felt particularly grateful for it as his mama bustled back onto the porch with a tray bearing three fresh cups of coffee and a little jug of something stronger, as Digger had requested. She set the tray on the table between them, taking a cup for herself and returning to the rocker she had previously occupied, allowing Digger a moment to collect himself. She turned to Waylon and picked up the thread of the story.
Your uncle was still unconscious when they found him. Now, Daddy thought it might be a sleeping sickness at first, kind of thing you don't ever wake up from. Mama just said no. Put him to bed, that he'd be fine.
She smiled sadly at her brother.
We were all worried, but Mama was right, as she always was. He slept another half a day, but then he woke up, and he was fine.
Digger snorted.
Yeah, those things might have been better if I hadn't.
Elpheus McCoy, you take that back. It would have broken Mommy and Daddy's hearts. And mine. If you...
I know you all love me, Netta, but your old Adams made a lot of trouble for our family when I came back down off that ridge, and Jeremiah didn't.
When young Digger McCoy and three other holler boys had not returned from their well-digging mission on a remote ridge at the edge of the county, their fathers had gone to the landowner, Shelton Bond, and demanded he lead them out to his claim to search for their missing sons. And the men had found Jeremiah Adams, Hank Webb, and Ansel Bentley dead at the scene, and Digger McCoy insensate on the ground nearby. They had retrieved Uriel Adams's cart, which he had loaned to the young men for their task, and used it to transport their dead back down the mountain to Glamorgan. The decision to take the boys to Glamorgan first rather than to their homes outside town was made at the insistence of Uriel Adams, whose shock at the discovery of his son's lifeless body had been quickly consumed by the flames of anger. His firstborn was dead, and by God, somebody was going to answer for that. When Shelton Bond offered his sincere condolences, but suggested they head on home to grieve in peace as the hour was getting late and his wife would have supper on the table, Uriel had drawn his pistol and suggested firmly that Mr. Bond accompany them to the county seat and the sheriff's office. Only with some gentle coaxing from both Frank Webb and Joseph Bentley was Uriel convinced to allow Elpheus McCoy to take his own still-living boy home to the tender care of his mother. Once he regained his senses, they assured him young Elpheus Jr. could be brought into town to offer his account of the afternoon's events to the sheriff. For the moment, more focused on whatever villainy Shelton Bond might have perpetrated on the boys, Uriel Adams had agreed. The force of the man's rage, just barely contained beneath his stiff, upright demeanor, was such that once the decision was made, he seemed to all but forget about the McCoys as Elpheus gently strapped his youngest son over his horse's back and led the biddable mare toward home. Would that he had truly forgotten about Digger altogether. However, when the sheriff looked over the dead boys and could find no wounds nor other sign of injury, the doctor was summoned to inspect the bodies. Old Doc Ingram maintained a tidy practice on the first floor of his home just a few blocks from the Esau County Courthouse. Ingram had finished his medical training just in time to be drafted into the war, where he had acquired a wealth of practical experience as a field medic. He was a skilled physician and a fair diagnostician, and he declared himself downright flummoxed by the state of Jeremiah Adams, Ansel Bentley, and Hank Webb. There was no question about the manner of death. The amount of water found in their lungs left no doubt as to that, but as to the means? He couldn't offer so much as a theory. How had three strapping young men managed to drown on dry land on a sunny summer afternoon? But that, he reasoned, was the sheriff's unfortunate problem to wrestle with, and he packed up his medical bag and excused himself. Doc Ingram might not have a clue of what had happened to his boy, but Uriel Adams felt he had an inkling. They'd gone out there to douse, had they not? Surely the boy who had earned such a reputation for seeking out water would have their answer. Adams had demanded they visit the McCoys that very night, but as the hour was growing late and the boy ill, the sheriff had put his foot down. They could wait and call upon Elpheus McCoy's son the following day. Although Uriel was waiting on the sheriff's office doorstep come sunup, what with one thing and another, it was mid-afternoon before the delegation of grieving fathers and lawmen arrived on Elpheus McCoy's doorstep, and that was for the best. By then, Digger had awakened and told his mommy and daddy everything that had happened out on the ridge, everything that was still happening. He confided to them quietly, his eyes swimming with unshed tears. He couldn't seem to silence the water's voice in his head. She had her hooks in him, and the song went on and on and on. Viola McCoy had soothed her son and given him a draft of strong herbal tea that helped to ease his nerves, though it could not quiet the song that wormed its way into his brain. His sister sat at his side reading books to him to help try to drown him out, and Elpheus McCoy was waiting on the porch when the men came to question the youngest of their clan. One of the neighbors had heard talk about the things Uriel Adams was saying, had come early in the morning to warn them that this man would not wait for Elpheus Jr. to come to town to give his statement, and so the family was as prepared as they could be when the sheriff came to call. Digger's parents sat protectively at his bedside, and Netta was banished to the kitchen to make room for the sheriff. Mr. Adams, Mr. Webb, Mr. Bentley, and a reedy little man from the courthouse who had come along to record Digger's statement. At his daddy's gentle encouragement, "Just tell him what happened, son. Take your time," Elpheus McCoy Jr. haltingly recounted what he recalled of the previous afternoon. The trip up the mountain and out onto the ridge, hearing the voice of the water, which was difficult to explain, but he did his best to describe the way he doused for Wellsprings and the way it suddenly turned on him and attacked his friends. His face was wet with tears as he described the way they struggled and choked and died, his own inability to help them. When his story was finished, no one said anything for a long time. The room was silent save for the gentle rasp of the court recorder's pen on paper. Then Uriel Adams muttered, "Bullshit," slapped his hat onto his head, and stormed from the room. The sheriff didn't quite manage to conceal a wince as the McCoy's front door slammed behind him. Frank Webb and Joseph Bentley exchanged a dark look. Mr. Webb glanced up at Digger and shook his head, and the two of them followed, though they shut the door behind them more respectfully. The sheriff dismissed the court recorder and then stepped outside with Elpheus McCoy to speak privately. Digger held his tears until all but his mother had departed, and Viola did her best to comfort him. The anger in the room had been palpable. It was clear his friends' fathers blamed him for their deaths, and he couldn't blame them. He had led them to whatever strange, wicked sort of water source lived out on Shelton Bond's ridge. He had failed to save them. He had carried the weight of that like a stone in his heart. Who could blame the men for holding him responsible as well? Elpheus and Viola assured him that he was not at fault, and that Uriel Adams and the others would soon see that. "They're hurting, son," Viola soothed. "Their hearts are full up with pain right now. There's no greater pain for a father and mother than to lose a child. Sometimes when folks are hurting, it feels so big they can't keep it inside them. They want to make the whole world feel for what they feel, so they lash out. But this'll pass. They'll soon see you're not to blame. You were hurt as well, though your gift probably saved you, bless it." Over the course of her long life, Digger and Netta had rarely known their mother to be wrong. But about this one matter, Viola McCoy could not have been more mistaken. The sheriff had assured Elpheus McCoy that his son would face no charges, although his story was unbelievable, and the sheriff theorized perhaps he'd taken a good knock upside the head. There was no evidence to suggest that Digger had harmed the boys in any way. He had, after all, been injured himself, however those mysterious injuries may have occurred. The incident was written off as an unfortunate accident. Death by misadventure, if you will. And as far as Esau County was concerned, the matter was settled. It was not settled for Uriel Adams, nor for Frank Webb or Joseph Bentley, who, though less vocal than Mr. Adams, could easily be stirred to his cause and nonetheless stood with him any time the opportunity to speak against the youngest McCoy rose. And Uriel Adams appeared to make it his business from then on to manufacture those opportunities as often and loudly as possible. Word spread throughout the county that the three men held Digger responsible for their son's deaths, and speculation about just what had happened up on Bond's Ridge spread like wildfire. Before long, many folks were whispering that Digger, whom they now called Grave Digger, had not merely led the boys to their deaths. He had murdered them.
Nobody really thought that. They were hurting and trying to make sense of things. But no one honestly thought that you...
Vinay, Netta, I thought Hank's brothers were going to kill me when they cornered me in the back of that feed shop that day. And anyway, that wasn't all of it. You know that. I figure that's why you brought the boy here to begin with.
Onetta shot her brother a fleeting, pained glance. There and gone in a heartbeat, but Waylon knew his mama. His eyes narrowed as he saw the look that passed between them. The wheels beginning to turn in his head.
The water. It killed the other boys but let you go. Why?
It didn't let me go. It got what it wanted from me. And I thought that'd be the end of it, that I should just be more careful or, hell, stop divining altogether. But I was wrong.
Digger's parents assured him the strange song of the water he had encountered on the ridge would fade so long as he stayed well clear of the place, but he saw the worried looks they exchanged. They didn't know. Not really. Although Elpheus and Viola had encountered similar manifestations of the natural world, what they referred to as the feral green, neither was a dowser. Nor did their gifts manifest in the way their sons did. As it turned out, that feral water had her hooks buried deep in Digger McCoy, and she wasn't letting go without a fight. He heard that voice calling to him, distant but ever present, morning, noon, and night. Some days it was faint, and he could forget about it for a while. Some days, the mental and spiritual tools his mom and daddy taught him to block it out worked better than others. But in the end, that voice was relentless, insidious. It would give him no peace. And it wanted things. Digger's friends had given it just a taste, but it wanted more. It wanted, well, it ever wanted. Every man, woman, and child in Boggs Holler, near as he could figure. Maybe even more than that. The song rattled through his head day in, day out, begging, pleading, tempting, promising, threatening. Bring me more, Elpheus McCoy. Bring me more. Digger began to think he was going crazy. The song was just so constant, so unrelenting. He began to contemplate the worst. What if he found someone bad? A man who beat his wife and children, say. Would it be so bad if he lured that man up on the ridge? On other days, he felt less afraid and more filled with despair. He contemplated offering himself up. Take me then. Just take me. Just enough already. But the water would fall strangely silent then, unimpressed with that offer. So Digger held on, trying every trick he knew to clear his mind, settle his heart, block any outside influences. He did his best to ignore the stares and the gossip, to turn the other cheek when boys his age shoulder-checked him in the schoolyard and younger children threw stones when he walked past on the road home.
He bore it all and prayed to every god he'd ever heard of to help him. And the voice of the water laughed and laughed. Until a bright Saturday morning when he stepped outside to begin his chores before breakfast. The voice of the water had been a low murmur for the past day or so, and he was actually feeling pretty cheerful. He whistled an old tune his mama sang to him as babies as he fetched a bag of feed from the barn and headed toward the chicken coop to turn the hens out into the yard and feed them. He spotted his older sister from across the yard drawing a bucket of water up from the well, and suddenly the water's insistent wail swelled in his ears, howling like a banshee and twice as loud. Want her, give her. Push her, push her, push, push, push. Digger fell to his knees, his hands clapping uselessly over his ears, screaming.
That's when I realized I had to get away. Not from the water. You clearly can't get away from water. It's in our blood. But away from Esau County, from that water source out on the ridge. Away from everybody I was putting in danger by being there.
Dig. You didn't have to do that. We would have found a way.
And then what, Netta? Even if we'd found a way to control it back home, do you really think I could live in Esau County with that hanging over me? Everybody calling me Grave Digger. People would cross the road to keep their kids away from me when I walked down the street in Glamorgan. What kind of life would I have had there?
And what kind of life is this?
Onetta's arm slung wide, the gesture encompassing the hillside around them.
Living up on top of this mountain like a hermit in a shack.
I'll have you know it's a very nice shack, Ms. Boggs.
Waylon looked stricken.
Is this your idea, Mama? I should just go out and live in the woods. I've got responsibilities. I've got...
Onetta and Digger responded at once.
No!
The siblings glanced at each other and Onetta nodded, signaling her brother should continue. He looked at Waylon kindly.
No, son, nobody is suggesting that. I'll admit at first that was all I could think to do, and I hoped it'd be enough, that if I got far enough away from that place on the ridge, I wouldn't hear that strange water calling me anymore. I could just go back to normal. But water, water's everywhere, and on some level it's all connected. I figured that out pretty quick. Was in my head all the time, whispering, cajoling, compelling me to do things. No, just going off by myself wasn't enough, but then Creature showed up on my doorstep.
At the sound, a Digger's pet name for him, Borgia, the regal Maine Coon, emerged from beneath the porch with an inquisitive mew, twining around the older man's ankles enthusiastically before hopping up onto his lap. Emmeline Underfoot followed at a more graceful pace, settling by Waylon's feet. Digger scratched Creature's chin affectionately.
Creature made all the difference, didn't you, boy?
Creature?
Oh, Creature's not just any old cat. He's special. Just like Miss Emmeline. Well, not just like her, but no ordinary ball of fur.
Creature's special talent, Digger explained, was that, he grew larger when danger was near. All cats had ways of appearing larger, of course, when they sensed danger. They hunched their backs and fluffed up their coats and tails, seeming to grow in size in the blink of an eye. But that was mostly stagecraft, a bit of the old razzle-dazzle. When Creature meant to grow bigger, he grew bigger for real. His spine and legs lengthening, his weight increasing considerably. He could grow to cover Digger like a warm and cozy blanket, a heavy blanket that he wasn't quite strong enough to move. What's more, his deep and melodious purr increased in volume, growing loud enough to drown out even that discordant feral shrieking in Digger's head, replacing it with a warm, peaceful rumbling.
Now, I'm not saying Miss Emmeline is the answer here. Her gifts aren't the same as Creature's. Hell, I don't think Creature's what would help you. What I mean is you have to find something that will help you control it, or even better, use it. Undermine it. Make it do what you want, not the other way around.
But what would that even be? Nothing I've tried so far has worked.
Digger rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
I have a few ideas. Things we can try. In the meantime, there's something else. Something I think you might be able to help me with.
Waylon glanced at his mama nervously, then returned his gaze to his uncle.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
Your mama says you got the gift from your daddy's side of the family. Is that right?
Waylon looked to his mama, who gave him a reassuring nod. Digger went on.
Well, there's an old schoolhouse down the mountain just outside of town. A friend of mine has been trying to fix it up, turn it into something useful again. He's not having much luck. Seems its former occupants haven't quite moved on, if you catch my meaning. If you're anywhere near as good as your daddy, I think you could help him out.
Digger glanced at Onetta, some unspoken communication passing between them that Waylon couldn't fathom.
I know you don't know me, Waylon. I've not exactly been living up to my duty as an uncle. But I'd appreciate it if you'd try.
Waylon looked back and forth between the two of them, trying to gauge if there was some trick hidden in his uncle's words, in his mama's hopeful smile, and finally he shrugged.
I won't make you any promises, but sure, I can try.
Digger clapped him on the shoulder.
Good man. We'll walk down in the morning and have us a look.
Digger retreated into the house, and after a moment they heard his bedroom door shut firmly behind him. Waylon and his mama gathered up the plates and cups, carrying them into the kitchen. Waylon volunteered to doing what little remained of the washing up and sent his mama off to get comfortable on the sofa in Digger's living room. He would make do with the cot Digger had set up in the kitchen, and no mama, he would be fine. Onetta had driven them a long way, and she should get some rest. Outside, Emmeline Underfoot, the gray ghost of Black Mountain, and Borgia, the mighty Maine Coon called Creature, loafed companionably under the porch steps, listening as their human companions made their nightly ablution.
I am pleased to hear you take such good care of the boy I once considered one of mine.
Creature preened.
It is as I said. I am Elpheus's protector. He would simply be lost without me.
I am sure he would. But tell me, what do you know of the schoolhouse your boy mentioned? Should I be concerned for my girl and her kit?
Creature flexed his claws, anchoring them into the boards of the porch as he flexed his back in a long contemplative stretch.
Elpheus's friend came up the mountain, about a moon past, carrying some tale of rappings and tappings on walls, old books being hurled through the air, and other such nonsense. The poor man seemed terrified, but after all, he is only human, and an ungifted one at that. Elpheus has attempted to rid the place of whatever lurks there. But as I'm sure you already know, old Grey Ghost, he doesn't really truck with spirits. If the kit is as talented as you say, I'm sure he will have little trouble.
Emmeline gave a thoughtful purr and rested her paws on her chin.
That is good to know, young one. I appreciate your insight,
she told him. And it was helpful information, and reassuring that Borgia did not appear to fear for his boy's safety. Still, they were in unfamiliar territory here, and Emmeline Underfoot, the Grey Ghost of Black Mountain, planned to accompany Waylon and his uncle on this little excursion in the morning. Just in case. Thus concludes part 3 of volume 2 of Familiar and Beloved, Kith and Kin. Our theme song is by Brother Land and Blood. Today's story was written by Cam Collins. The voice of Onetta Boggs was Betsy Puckett. The voice of Waylon Boggs was Brandon Bentley. The voice of Digger McCoy was John Patrick McAfee. The voice of the water was Sarah Lynch Thomason. The voice of Borgia the Mighty Maine Coon was Shane Burke. And the voice of Emmeline Underfoot, Gray Ghost of Black Mountain, was Amory Helton. Join us for the next installment of Familiar and Beloved, exclusively on Patreon.
Lonesome call, familiar song, oh, bring us home.